In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Flushing Meadows Corona Park is the site of the previous World's Fairs that took place in 1939 and then in 1964. It's located in Queens, New York City. From the air, the geometric layout of the park interrupts a dense residential grid, and it's also a significant ley line avenue feeding the telluric currents descending out of Manhattan. In 1968, the Flushing Meadows Zoo opened in Flushing Meadows Park on the grounds of the 1964-65 World's Fair. There were a range of animals and exhibits, including sea lions, bears, sheep, bison, mountain lions, coyotes, eagles, birds, and wolves. However, reports of UFO-related events occurred at the zoo since the beginning. In fact, one event I'd never know about had it not been for a longtime listener, Brandon Brigadier, who was a guest on the show a number of years ago. He lives out in Long Island, and he recently told me how every animal in the zoo was found dead. It happened overnight. In the next hour, we get into the details of some strange occurrences. Our guest is Bill Nell. He's a well-known author, writer, and paranormal researcher. He's been reporting on UFOs and paranormal mysteries for the last 40 years. He's the author of many books and has consulted for numerous major motion pictures, including Independence Day and Men in Black. He's also made frequent appearances on network television shows discussing UFO events. His website is billnellsworld.com, spelled billnellsworld.com. I'll link it to inothernewsradio.com as well. A warm welcome, Bill, to In Other News.
Well, thank you for welcoming me. I'm glad to be here.
Bill, I've visited the World's Fairgrounds a few times, but I didn't walk over to the zoo. In fact, I didn't know about it. Anyway, it's a large park, and in your article, The Flushing Meadows Park Zoo Animal Mutilations and UFO Mystery, you give an in-depth historic background of the area, such as the use of the buildings through the years. Would you describe this area to give listeners some context, please?
Well, the area was largely swampy, unused land. But what happened was, because it's right off something called the Flushing Canal. However, they started dumping ashes there. In those days, you know, we're talking around 1900 and up, they started dumping ashes from coal. Because at that time, the main fuel for fireplaces, for cooking and everything else, was coal. And what did they do with the ashes? Well, they dumped it all over there. So it was kind of a pseudo-landfill. It became a landfill. And as time went on, you know, it got a little grassy, it got nice. But for some reason, it was never developed. So eventually, what ended up happening was they turned it into the 1962-64 New York World's Fair, because it was the only open area left in the city, basically, that wasn't being used or didn't have plans for use. And then they figured later, like with the zoo. The zoo was supposed to be built during the fair, actually, originally. But those plans fell through because they had a few more people that wanted to get involved with the fair, a few more sponsors and such that wanted to have their pavilions put up, like General Electric and New York Telephone and so on. So eventually they just said, well, we'll wait till the fair's over. And they did. They built the zoo in around 1968. And that's when it opened up. And it got bigger. It's gotten bigger over the years. It's very popular. People don't know this, but every single borough in New York City has their own zoo except for Staten Island. Poor Staten Island got left out, you know, probably because it's not that big. However, the area has always had strange activity. UFOs have been seen there for as long as people have been there. In that area, the area over by LaGuardia Airport, the old area over by the Grand Central Parkway, Van Wyck Expressway, people have seen things over there. And now we're not talking about planes, because in the early, you know, around 1900, there were no planes. So you're talking about things being seen. And in those days, if you go back to the old Long Island Press and some of the old newspapers that have been around a while, you'll find out that they're called airships. And of course, in 1899, there was a great airship flap over the entire United States. People were seeing these things, which they called airships, that were unexplained in the air. Obviously, they weren't balloons. There were balloons available at that time, but these weren't balloons. There were too many to be counted as balloons. There weren't that many balloons. But it's pretty interesting area with a long history of strangeness.
It definitely is. And I think in your article you mentioned one of the buildings was once used by the United Nations. Can you talk about that?
Sure. There's a building in there, and it's been a lot of different things. But it's a large, white, very state-looking building, and it was used by the League of Nations. That was, of course, only lasted a few years. But that was their home base. The United Nations wasn't built until later. That was well after World War II. But yeah, it was the League of Nations, and then later it became the swim club. And then it became like an aquatic center where you could go and see shows. If you've ever been in the building, they took about half the building and they made seats out of them. It's open air. It's kind of like if you've ever been to Jones Beach and you've ever been to the Jones Beach Theater, that's exactly what it's like, except the other part of the building is all offices and stuff as well. But it's a well-used building, and it's on a small, I don't want to call it a lake because it's not that big, but I guess a very large pond would be. You know, during the World's Fair, they would take people out in these aquatic cars. There were cars that were built to go right into the water, and they had little propellers on the back. So that's what they used it for during the World's Fair as well. But that building was there, and it's too bad. After the fair ended, they really tore down a lot of the most popular things, including the monorail ride, which was very... I was there at the time. I did go to the fair several times and really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you about that, if you had gone to one of the fairs. And now you have the tennis courts out there and, of course, Met Stadium. How long after the World's Fairs did they start building out that area?
I would say within almost immediately, because some of the buildings were repurposed. You know, they were repurposed for, as I said, for other things. I know, well, of course, today you have a Museum of Art out there. You've got a New York State Pavilion out there. You've got a whole bunch of stuff out there today. But it was kind of strange, just to talk about strangeness. Okay, my life has been a life of coincidences, and here's one of them. My dad had retired from the military. He was an Air Force general, and he worked for a company called Construction Equipment, which sold and rented construction equipment. And one of the contracts they had was for the New York World's Fair. So he helped build all those Disney exhibits, like the World of Tomorrow, the dinosaur exhibit in the Ford Pavilion, where you'd get in a Ford car, a latest model Ford car, and you'd ride around on a track, and they take you through ancient times and dinosaurs. Disney did all the animatronics for that. Great moments with Mr. Lincoln. Today, that would be the Hall of Presidents. But we got to go there about a week before the fair actually opened because of my dad's connection and try out all the rides. And that was great. But here's the strange part. I'm always looking for odd stories because I had a little, as a kid, I put out a little newsletter, kind of in the neighborhood kind of newsletter, about odd occurrences on Long Island, because Long Island's one of the oddest places you could ever live in terms of ghosts, UFOs. It's just a haunted place. When we were there, I heard one of the maintenance men talking about something. He said, "Did you see that the other day? I thought a plane was crashing." So I couldn't help. I said, "Dad, I'm going to go talk to this guy." And I was like 10. You know, so when I go over and I ask him, I say, "Excuse me, sir, but I heard you talking about something. What was that?" He said, "Oh, the other night I saw this thing coming down near the park, and I thought it was a plane crashing, so I called the police. But then I had to call them back because it wasn't. It was just the light, a big white light, you know, like you'd see on the front of a plane." So I said, "Oh, my goodness." So right then and there, even at that age and at that time in 1964, I saw, you know, I had somebody who had already seen something just casually talking about it. It just shows you the weirdness of the place.
Strange lights in the sky were often seen in the area for many, many years. And, you know, it's probably been like that for a very long time. Would you please tell listeners about a few more of these reports and what, if possible, did these UFOs look like?
Well, now there were two types that were seen quite a bit in that area. There were the large white lights. At night, they were white lights, but during the day, discs were seen, the classic early flying saucers. They're still seen today. I mean, they're seen quite a bit. Probably those and the cigar-shaped UFOs are the most commonly seen all around the world. But in that area, they were lights, nocturnal lights. That would be a kind of a classified as a close encounter of the first kind, if you follow the close encounters session of figuring things out. But anyway, the discs were seen during the day, and the lights were seen at night, and then there were green balls of light. These are very common UFOs, and these can be odd sizes. For example, they're like the orange balls of light, less common, but also interesting. They can be the size of a quarter into hundreds of feet in diameter. So I don't know. I'm thinking that perhaps the smaller ones are some sort of drones, you know, used by the larger ones. I don't know. There's just not enough information available. But based on my research, that's what I believe. So you had those kind of things being seen. In fact, there's a very, very old Quaker settlement in Flushing. It's a Quaker house. You can still go see it today. Today it's an historic monument, but back in those days it was being used. I'm talking about the early 1900s. Now, I got a tip from somebody who had seen, I had a cable show running on Queens Cable, Cablevision, and about UFOs and such, and somebody called me and they said, did you know that the Quakers wrote about this? I said, no, I didn't. He said, well, I used to work in the Quaker house, and they have a kind of old log books in there, and the Quakers were very good at keeping logs. And apparently they wrote about seeing strange lights in the sky. So historically speaking, you know, Flushing, it used to be known as the home of the millionaires, because all millionaires lived there and built big mansions and stuff and big houses. And it's just odd that all these people would see these things. In fact, there were a couple of cases. I spoke to one elderly man, I think in the late 70s. He was probably in his 80s. And he told me that he remembered going to the Keith Theater, the Keith Movie Theater, down by Main Street and Northern Boulevard in Flushing. And he was getting out to see a movie. He was parking his car. And he saw what he swore was a huge cigar-shaped thing. Now, it was headed directly over Flushing, what today would be Flushing Meadow Park. And it was huge. He said it was only about, he figured offhand, it probably was about 150 to 200 feet high in the air, which is nothing, you know. I mean, and he was absolutely freaked out by it. He said, I'll never forget it. And he was thankful that he was finally able to tell somebody who would actually believe him, because everybody kind of thought he was nutty, but no, and I'm sure other people saw it as well. They just didn't report it.
250 feet in the sky, that's pretty low, Bill. So it's evident that there is a pattern of UFO activity in this area. And of course, this is only what's reported. I would imagine there's a lot more activity. In 1977, something very strange happened at the Queens Zoo. Again, right in this area, Flushing Meadows Park. Please tell listeners about this event.
Sure. Let me start by prefacing this with my website, because I go into great detail on my website about these incidents, and I think they find it perhaps as interesting as I do. My website is www.billnellsworld.com. BillNellsWorld, BillNellsWorld.com. Okay. In 1977, there was something that happened that was so strange. And I got this from one of the actual park workers who actually heard me on the radio and read about me in the newspaper and wanted to report it to me. We had a UFO sighting hotline at that time. And he said that what caused the whole interest in the thing was some wolves got out of the Flushing Meadows Park Zoo. They apparently, I don't know if they'd pushed through the gating that they had around there. How they got out, I'm not exactly sure. But they were running all around the zoo, and somebody called the police. So the police come, they get the park officials come, everybody comes, and the wolves were actually scared to death, literally. I mean, they looked like they'd been in shock or something. They weren't displaying normal, I guess you could say, wolfen behavior. So then they get them back to the zoo, and they have them tranquilized, get them back to the zoo. When they get there, they found several animals, including a large bear, dead and strangely mutilated. Now, it wasn't very many animals. I asked him to do a guesstimate, tell me what he thought. He said it might have been 10 animals, which is still a lot, you know, but in terms of actually how many there were, maybe 10. But here's the thing. They were all found, and they were found bloodless, and that really freaked everybody out. Now, several nights before and after that, people reported that they were green glowing UFOs seen over the Grand Central Parkway, again over Van Wyck and over the park. So that's pretty much of a central area. Now, it may be that the park is some sort of a magnet for these things, because they do tend to appear near places like old roads. For example, the roads surrounding the park, including what today would be Codge Point Boulevard, but what back then was called Pittman, those roads, basically, they're very ancient trails, so that would go along with that. Plus, if there's large power lines, they'll be around those. You know, it's just, for some reason, UFOs tend to follow, you know, those things. So anyway, I think this was a shocking event. I was stunned to find out about it, but as we'll talk about here in a bit, that was just the beginning.
Right. This is 1977, a major sighting that caught the attention of investigators occurred in March of 1989 when a bus driver saw what appeared to be a glowing object landing in the park around 9 p.m. at night. Please tell listeners, if you would, about this sighting that was about to be a catalyst for finding out about a major paranormal event.
Well, this sighting really, for me, was the most exciting thing I've ever worked on, because even though up until that time I've had many exciting cases, but I couldn't always talk about them all, you know, because I had to promise people a certain level of confidentiality. But this one was interesting because, now, everybody that knows New York City, and not everybody does, obviously, but if you know Flushing, you probably know the Q65 line, because it goes right up the street. It goes right up, I believe it might be 45th Avenue, I'm not sure. But anyway, it goes right up the street and all the way past the park. Now, it's about, I don't know, 9 p.m. at night, sometime around that time. It was dark. I know that. And there were a whole bunch of people on the bus. And fortunately for me, one of the people on the bus knew my wife. And as it turned out, she called after the whole thing was over, and she said, this is what happened. We're going past the park. We see this huge, bright light. It's kind of like the light you'd see shining from a police helicopter, where they shine the light down. So they thought at first that a helicopter was trying to make an emergency landing in the park. So, of course, in those days, by that time, the bus drivers had an emergency radio that they could use on the bus. It looked like a telephone. They'd pick it up, and they'd be able to contact their home base. So he called in immediately, but it was pretty obvious after a few minutes when the thing turned, and it wasn't so bright, that this was a classic disc-shaped UFO, which came down very low. Now, it may have landed. It's hard to tell from where they were at. They had a great view of it, but it was dark. And the only lights in the park were the lights that surround the Flushing Pond. And this happened right on the side. If you know Casino Park, you'd actually go see it today, the area. It surrounded the lights around Flushing Pond. It was just to the center of Flushing Pond and a few yards from the walkway that walks around the pond. Now, what happened next was really interesting, because once I found out about it, I went right over there the next day, and of course, I talked to, luckily, my wife's friend, Doris, her name. Doris actually got people to call my hotline. You know, I gave cards to everybody. Everybody had my business card, hotline number on it, and she happened to have four or five, so she gave them out, and they all called, so I knew this was something major. I got to talk to the bus driver as well. But anyway, this thing hovered there for a few minutes. Now, it hit a tree going back up. It hit the tree, then it straightened itself out and went straight up in the air after a few minutes. It was a while, though. It could have been as long as 30 minutes. It's hard to tell because everybody was in shock. You know, it's like when you're seeing something unfold and you're watching it. I mean, that bus was parked. He parked the bus. He stopped. He was going to make sure this wasn't a plane or helicopter crash. More likely helicopter, since it was standing still. And he was going to make sure of that before he took any further action. But the thing was, when I went to the park the next day, I found this kind of like circular area. It's almost like a crop circle, if you've heard of those things and your listeners have. The crop circle was about 30 feet in diameter, which, by the way, is the most common-sized crop circle, except it was a grass circle. Now, inside, here's the strange part. Outside the circle, dead fish were found. Now, I want to know how in the world anyone could get the fish out of the lake and put them over there and kill them. They were just dead. Well, inside the circle, there was this type of quartz feldspar. It's a stony substance that's not found anywhere else in the park. It's not native to the park. It doesn't belong there. But there it was. And in fact, I had Ted Bennett, who was a gemologist and a professor at Nassau County Community College, look at it. And he said it was oddly shaped because quartz feldspar normally is very sharp, and this was kind of rounded. It was unusual. And he had mentioned that. And I thought, that's great. We have two forms of evidence that something happened there. But here's the best thing to me. When I said it hit the tree, as time went on and I kept investigating the case, we all noticed that rather quickly the tree started to die just on one side, on the side that was hit, just on that side, which really blew everybody's minds, including mine. And some of the, I just happened to, my friend Joe, who's into science and stuff, and he's an engineer writer, he writes, technical writer, and he told me, he said, why don't you see if there's any unusual magnetism over there or radiation? Well, he had a magnetometer, and he also had a Geiger counter, because he had done some work with the government, and we brought the Geiger counter out there. There was no unusual background radiation or anything, but the three streetlights that surround the pond that were closest to the circle were all highly magnetized. I mean, you could take a piece of metal, right, and take it, or a coin or something, take it out of your pocket, maybe not a coin, a metal in there, but a piece of metal, and it would stick to the light, to the stem of the streetlight. It's just unbelievable. So we have all this evidence, and the dead fish, I don't know what to say about that. They weren't mutilated, they were just dead, and how they got there, I have no clue. But I have a feeling, and I'm guessing about this, this thing may have taken some water samples or for its own needs out of the pond, because it was right by the pond, just on the other side of it. But it was in a perfect area, because there's only a few trees right there where the circle was, so it'd be the perfect place to land. Even you could probably land a helicopter there. It'd be tight, but you could probably do it. But again, this was no helicopter. And all this evidence, well, what ended up happening was I took a few days to really get into this and talk to the witnesses and everything. Then my friend Mike Luckman, he had a UFO society in Manhattan, and he wrote a great book about rock and rollers who've seen UFOs. So I liked him a lot. He's a good guy. He could call a press conference in 30 minutes. He was a publicist. You know, you got to do it. He said, Bill, you need to put this out to the public. I said, I know. What would you suggest? He said, let me call a press conference. Well, he called a press conference. And I mean, within a day, we had CNN, we had NBC, we had the local stations, national stations. Everybody came out to hear about this. Because it wasn't the kind of thing where, oh, some guy was walking in the park at night and just happened. No, this was a whole busload of people. There were some people in the houses, because we did canvassing. We went to houses that were living right on the right side of the park from there. Because even though the park's extremely big, that part and the lake part, it's right next to a suburban area. I shouldn't say suburban, urban, but mostly houses area. So we did find some people who saw the exact same thing, except they only remember seeing a really bright light in the park, and they thought the same thing. They thought either police were chasing somebody with their helicopter and landed it, or some other helicopter landed. But again, they said the odd thing was, unlike a helicopter, there was no noise whatsoever. In other words, nobody heard anything. And I know the bus driver told me, I turned off the bus just to hear and see if there was a possibility, you know, that this was a helicopter, but I heard no noise. And it really freaked everybody out that it was completely quiet. So it kind of set the stage for other things, because once this was out to the press, oh, a whole bunch of people were calling our hotline like crazy. Couldn't even keep up with it. Luckily, thank God for answering. Basically, what happened was we got tips on so many other sightings, including one. Now, because I did interview some of the people that worked in Flushing Meadow Park, in Flushing Casino Park. By the way, this, I don't know if I mentioned it, because I get lost in it because there's so much information. It's called Casino Park, and most people that live in Queens or live near Queens know about it. It's a huge park. It's fabulous. And it's funny because that park system, Casino Park, a couple of others, they've also been areas of intense UFO sightings. Now, another park just down the way near Fresh Meadows. I always call it the Fresh Meadows Park. There's the remnants of an old Long Island Highway that runs through, and there's even an old stone bridge. They've been finding mutilated animals there for years and years. And they always thought that this was something that Satanists were doing. Now, I don't think there's a whole lot of Satanist cults around, but you never know, because they found some symbols or something on a tree. But I'm thinking the mutilations happened first then the Satanists claimed it as their own, because there were also many UFO sightings over that area as well, over Fresh Meadows, which is a large open area with many, many, so I think there's like 5,000 apartment units in that area, but there's also open areas there. So you've got two parks so far. Now, we're not counting Flushing Meadows yet, because I've only partially mentioned that story. But basically, talking to the park people that work in these areas, you know, kind of connected me up with some others.
And the fact that this disc landed in one of the most densely populated cities in the world is very unusual. It did not pick a remote location, which it could have. For some reason, it risked a lot to do what it needed to do at that location. I think that's interesting as well.
Well, let me say this, too. This was only the beginning of the weirdness, because what ended up happening was, a year later, after this happened, an identical UFO, identical, landed in Baranez, Russia, in a park right off the city. It was similar to the casino park, because it was right next to a large city, and right next to Baranez. And it was so crazy, because everybody saw it. It was broad daylight, though. People saw it, kids saw it, men saw it, women saw it, everybody saw it. And here's the thing. Aliens came out of that thing. Unlike the small little gray creatures you always hear about, these were larger, taller creatures that looked very odd, but they looked humanoid. They still looked humanoid. And it was a very similar event, except for the part of aliens coming out. So once again, a year later, boom, our site, you know, our site and our story came back up on the news, because they found out, well, here's, what's the odds, okay, if this is a natural event, what's the odds that two separate events are going to be, you know, so much alike? And when you think about it, for those who don't know Flushing, Flushing by itself has over 1 million people living there. And that's not even counting, you know, Brooklyn area, Queens area, not counting the areas up by Elmhurst or Astoria. No. So that's a lot of people. So I know a lot. And believe me, we got calls. One of the fire departments down there called me, and they said they had actually been given the call to come out and investigate this, you know, even though it wasn't a fire. It could have been something that might have interested them. So they sent investigators out the next day. So this is something that was really seen and covered by many people. One of the firemen said that he had heard about it, and he spoke to, let's see, who was it? It might have been one of his aunts. I just don't recall the stuff I had on my notes. But one of his aunts said that she had been seeing it as well. She had been driving by the park that night. You know, it's not hard to find witnesses to this. The same thing happened at Veritas. It's not hard to find witnesses. And in fact, it was odd, because at that time, Baranez was still very much in the Soviet Union. They hadn't switched over yet. So in the Soviet Union, they tend to not put out information much about UFOs. But in this case, they did. TASS News, the official Soviet and Russian news agency, had it on their front page and put it out on their radio broadcast, because it was just one of those things that, you know, they weren't even going to try to hide it. So it was something that really ballooned. But, you know, I don't think these things are particular. I don't think they consider where they're landing or what they're doing. They've just got some sort of agenda, which even if they could speak perfect English, they might not be able to explain it to us. You know, we always put everything in human terms, you know. It's like, I know you're a fan of, and I am as well, Carl Jung, the famous Swiss psychiatrist, psychologist, whatever you want to call him, one of the fathers of modern psychology. He gave us our modern personality types. That was his biggest thing that he gave us, which is great. But I'm a big fan, because he was the only one, unlike Freud and the others of his time, that bothered to investigate flying saucers. He actually wrote a mini book, it's like a booklet on them. And he thought they were either real machines driven by aliens, mandalas, kind of us seeing the better part of ourselves, something like that. It was just, it's wild. But so, you know, this is the interesting thing. You find these things going back centuries. You know, there are ancient drawings of disc-shaped objects, cigar-shaped objects, orange, white, and green balls of light. And apparently, I know I went to a place in Long Island, and I got to tell you a little bit about it. It's called Mount Misery. It was called that because during the 18th century, they had a, I guess you want to call it, an early insane asylum there. And, of course, they had no treatment. They would just lock up those people in those days. So you'd hear the wails and crying of them at night and during the day, and that's how it got it. So farmers gave it that adage, Mount Misery. But it's an area known for many, many UFO sightings. There's an old church there that exists right on the bottom of the hill. And I went to, when I was investigating these cases, I found out that the church also had, and this is not unusual because they tend to keep, they were the record keepers of the day. They noted that there were several animal mutilations out there, as well as strange lights in the sky. And that really blew me away. Because here, once again, you know, years ago on the Johnny Carson show, one of the chief people that was involved, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, he was involved with the United States government Project Blue Book study. And he, Johnny asked him, well, if I wanted to see a UFO, where is the most common place for UFO sightings in the United States? And bear in mind, this guy's not even from our area, but he's a guy that knows the area. He said, without a doubt, Long Island. And I'm like, wow.
I wonder, Bill, if it has something to do with being surrounded by water. I mean, often water plays a role, whether some of these ships are going in the water. Maybe there are submerged realms that some of these creatures live in. We don't know, but I'm curious about what you've read or heard about that.
Well, the author and pretty much of a famous speaker, John Keel, who wrote the Mothman Prophecies, he was one of the people that believed and often talked about the fact that there was probably a sunken UFO base, in other words, a base underwater off the coast of Long Island. And he was a New Yorker, not native, but he was a New Yorker, lived in New York for many, many years. And even he knew about this. So, and the best thing was, I've always been into boats, and, you know, my family, we had a small 18-foot skiff, no big deal. Put an outboard motor on the back and went out fishing, you know. But we used to fish near Oyster Bay. And I had subscribed to a magazine called Rudder Magazine. This was a very, very popular boating magazine, especially in the 60s. And in the 68, they came out with an article, which blew me away, because by then, even though I was still, you know, basically a young teenager, you know, very, I think I was about 12 at the time, they had an article warning boaters, and they had incidents, which they quoted in the article. If a UFO comes near your boat, try to stay away from it. Try to immediately start your engine and get away, because if it does, the likelihood of your engine conking out and you not being able to get it restarted is very high. And I thought, man, it's Rudder Magazine. And they actually had some photos taken by fishermen and boaters of UFOs that they saw near their boats. But I thought, man, this is Rudder Magazine. This isn't Fate or one of those magazines, you know, and it's in there. So it's obvious it's something. And, of course, over the years, I've had so many stories of people seeing underwater flying objects, if you will, underwater objects. People, well, here, one of the most famous. It didn't happen right there. On his voyage of discovery, Christopher Columbus, in 1492, he had gone into an area in the mid-Atlantic called the Sargasso Sea. Okay, and the Sargasso Sea, you know, you always end up in the doldrums. There's not a lot of wind there. And his crew was pretty angry. They were almost mutinying, practically going to mutiny, because he couldn't get his ships out of there. And they thought he was leading them to nothingness, that you just reach the end of the world and fall off. Nobody, you know, apparently they didn't know about America or our North American continent at the time. So during that time, all of a sudden, this thing appeared the right side of the ship, and they saw it underwater as a bright, glowing object. It came up out of the water, stood around the surface for a few seconds, then went straight up and out of sight. Now, this was seen by the crew, and he was lucky, because the true crew took it as a sign of good luck, and they didn't mutiny. And in fact, after a short time, maybe a few hours, the wind kicked up, and they got out of there, because the doldrums of the Sargasso Sea were known to all sailors who had sail ships back in those days. So even he saw it, underwater object. So these are very common. They're a lot more common than people actually talk about, because obviously if something happens out in the ocean, you'd have to be there, you know. Well, more recently, they had that one particular UFO, which everybody calls the Tic Tac, which was seen by Navy jets that were dispatched to intercept something that I guess had popped up on the radar, and which they normally don't, so they're kind of lucky in that sense. And the thing just sat there, and then it went completely out of sight. All the flyers agreed that this was something that was absolutely impossible for a normal jet or normal type of object with a human being inside to do. Now, I said earlier that my dad was an Air Force general. Well, you can imagine growing up in that house, because he would have flyers come over, pilots, you know, both private and former military and current military. And what I used to do is, when he had his famous summer barbecues, where everybody would just kind of come over, and we had, you know, nice little house in Long Island, and in East Meadow, in fact. And they would come over, and I'd listen to their stories. And at that time, UFOs and flying saucers, which is what they tended to be called. The term UFO was created by the government. Now they're calling them aerial phenomena. That's the newest term. But when Project Blue Book started, they coined the term unidentified flying object, because they were trying to get away from the alien explanation. But the average person called them flying saucers, because that's what some of the first ones looked like, and what some of the first people that saw them, like Kenneth Arnold, he saw several of them flying near Mount Rainier in Washington State. He coined them flying saucers. He said, they look like saucers. They moved like saucers skipping across the water. And that's how the term came about. But anyway, yeah, the thing was, I'd hear the stories from the pilots and stuff. And they all had stories. It wasn't like just a few. Maybe if there were 10 people present, 10 pilots present, or ex-pilots or current, at least 6 or 7 of them had stories to tell. So apparently these things are a lot more common. And the military sightings are a whole lot more common than anybody really knows. So I was fascinated by this. And a lot of them did indeed take place over water. We've had famous incidents involving battleships that have seen these things. During World War II, our pilots nicknamed them Foo Fighters, because Foo is the French word for fire. And some of the early French pilots used that term, so they started using it as well. And the funny thing was, now, my dad was on General MacArthur's staff during World War II, and he was commissioned by MacArthur to do a report on these things, because MacArthur was truly concerned. He made a speech at West Point where he once famously said that our next war will not be an international war, it'll be an intergalactic war, because he believed these were aliens. I suspect he knew they were aliens, and he was concerned about their agenda. But my father did a report, and what he would do is he would have his staff interview pilots who had seen these things after the sighting. And, oh, man, it was over 10,000 pages long, and it's still classified to this day. I'd love to get a copy of it just for memory's sake, you know, but I can't because it's still classified. But I know it exists because my dad said it did, and others have told me as well in the government that it does exist. And these, again, what do they look like? They look like flying balls of fire or flying balls of light. They tended to be white and orange for the most part. But again, some are green. Just again, you have this history, very long history of sightings where everything is repeating itself. So think about the odds, which could be in the billions, I suppose, that these were all just random events or even a natural phenomena. You know, these days we're technologically savvy. We tend to know what weather does. We tend to know what happens up in the sky. And no natural explanation, in my book anyway, can account for these sightings.
That's a really good point, Bill, that it's beyond randomness. It's beyond coincidence for the most part. I appreciate you going through a number of the examples of UFO sightings over water, and it's historic. And there are many, many accounts of that. And we have Long Island. And if listeners aren't sure of this, Queens and Brooklyn are part of Long Island, technically. It's one continuous landmass out there all the way to North Fork, Montauk, which is another subject in and of itself. Let's go back now to this landing that you were alerted to back in March of 1989. And from there, you found out about another incident. If you would, can you begin to tell listeners what had happened here?
Absolutely. After I started speaking to a number of park employees, as I said, I discovered that apparently there was a tremendous amount of activity over the park, several of them, which, you know, as far as anybody knew, people were seeing them, but they weren't reporting them for fear of ridicule and stuff. But anyway, I met this one guy called me on my hotline. They said, look, I want to tell you about something involving the zoo in the Flushing Meadow Park. So, okay, went to see him, went to meet him at the park, near the zoo, but not in the zoo because he still worked there. Didn't want to lose his job. So I had to kind of keep him, you know, under the cuff a little bit. But he brought a couple of other guys with him. which was nice. And they all said, you know what happened here in 1986? I said, no, what happened? He said, well, he said, I heard on the morning news, when I got up in the morning, that apparently there was some sort of UFO sightings over the Grand Central. And apparently so many, you know, it happened at a time when a lot of people just happened to be on the highway. So it wasn't by any means an isolated incident somewhere in the desert, you know. So, okay, what happened? He said, well, I come to work the next morning, and I had a shocking experience. I was the first one to get in. Nobody had been to zoo all night. Nobody. They didn't need it. They had a good alarm system. They didn't need a caretaker. I guess they just didn't have the budget for it or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, because most zoos have somebody there. Well, maybe it's good they didn't. Because he found every single animal, fish, goats, an elephant, a bear, on and on and on, all dead, strangely mutilated and completely devoid of blood. Now, animal mutilations go back thousands of years. They're nothing new. They're almost always associated with UFO sightings. Since the 1960s, when people started keeping track, ranchers have reported over 10,000 cattle mutilations. So again, not isolated incidents, and they go on today. I guess the press just got tired of reporting it, so they kind of ignore it, because nobody can explain it. The mutilations are surgical, and that's exactly what they found at the zoo. He said, look, I'm no doctor, but to me it almost looked like somebody had performed operations on them. And I said, man, it would be nice to know what organs were taken, if any, but I couldn't get that information. This incident was shocking, and it was what was more shocking was they got the police over there. They had everybody but the Secret Service. I'm not kidding you. They had members of they had naval surgeons come there, naval doctors. The incident was covered up immediately. He had to go stencil some park clothes signs, zoo clothes signs, rather, sorry, and staple them or tape them up all around the gates on to the zoo. And I have a picture, and I show in my seminar. Again, you can go to my website at www.billnellsworld. It's BillNellsWorld.com, and read all this and see all the good stuff. And there's all a bunch of free videos you can watch on there, you know. But anyway, this was something that was shocking, beyond shocking. There were 300 animals. 300 animals were strangely mutilated, and, you know, the ones that had, you know, not like fish, but ones that had blood, the blood was gone. You know, you think you're going to find a bloody mess if Satanists or somebody did, or some horrible people that just had nothing better to do with their time. But no, there was literally no blood. It looked like somebody had either cleaned it up, or, well, it didn't even look like that. It looked like there never was any blood. So where did all the blood go? Go to a butcher shop, you're going to see blood. You just didn't. Then immediately after that, the cover-up started. It took a while. It took almost a year of that being closed. They basically redid the entire zoo. When I say redid, let me explain. They took down not all, but most of the buildings. They just took them down. They put up brand new buildings. But before they did that, they took about, I think he said, 3 to 6 inches, said depending on the area that was affected. He said the dirt and the circular, and excuse me, like the circular area in Casino Park, the grass in the park was strangely affected. It was dying, just like that. So in other words, he's telling me that everything, it was a huge effect, and that's why they had to do this. They took 3 to 6 inches of soil, and he was there all that time, so he remembers it. They put down new soil, they put up new buildings, and they reopened it, and they kind of disguised it. They said, oh, well, this was something we were going to do anyway. And now, this was the middle of summer, okay? So here's the question. Would you really want to do that in the middle of summer when the zoo is at its busiest and people are going there? Well, of course not. You do it in the fall. You know, it gets cool and people start staying in. None of it makes any sense. And I didn't see one item. The only paper, I think it was the Casino Tribune, which is a local paper in Flushing, Queens, and Bayside, Queens, that basically had this, you know, they had the story. They just said the zoo was closed and that for unknown reasons, that's how they put it. That's exactly how they covered it. See, nobody can believe this. And I think that the media tends to, not only do they slant the news, but one thing they do which really upsets me is they censor it. It's not their job to censor our news. It's our news, and we have a right to it. And when 300 animals are killed, we have a right to know why or how or if something's being done to protect these animals in the future, which apparently is not being done. But I know after that, you go there today and there's cameras everywhere. As soon as you get to the entrance, there's cameras. And I'm sure that's for many reasons. But there's an awful lot of clothes. I've been there since. So I know I used to think. I lived in Flushing for many years, so I took my kids. I am a native New Yorker. I was born in Queens.
You know, I wanted to ask you, Bill, it must have been really strange to have been talking to these employees, especially after knowing about this incident with the disc landing, and thinking to yourself, how did I not hear about this? I'm as plugged in as possible into paranormal events in this area, yet this got by me.
Well, what happened was I didn't really start my UFO hotline until about 1980, okay? So, I mean, it was on at the time. But again, you have to remember, this was quickly covered up. I mean, nobody, weren't any zoo patrons there at the time. You know, nobody was in the zoo. It was just the maintenance men and stuff that showed up in the morning. So I would imagine it wasn't that hard to cover. Now, why? They might have not been aware. I didn't really get well known in the New York area until after 1986, until the Casino Park event happened in 1989. Then I ended up with I had a cable show sponsored by Time Life Books. I was in the front page of Newsday a couple times, New York Newsday. I was in the Long Island Press. I was in, all these different, a New Yorker wrote an article about me and the Casino Park case. So, you know, but it took a while. So I'd always, whenever I did an article, I'd preface it by saying I'd really like you to put, there was no internet in those days, so I'd really like you to put my hotline in there so that if people have stories, I could get them, you know. I've written up to 40 books at this point on different subjects, mostly UFOs, because, you know, you can't even, you know, I still have stuff I've never even written down. So I have come across many UFO incidents. But at that time, when that occurred in 77, for example, I might not even have been in the area because I do a lot of, but I hadn't really been focusing much on what was going on in Flushing.
I see. Thanks for clarifying that. And it sounded like that was the beginning, the inception of some kind of recognition of your work and research in this particular area. Getting back now to this event, the animals that were there were wolves, bears, mountain lions, birds, seals. What ultimately had happened to these animals?
Well, apparently they were moved out the very next day. Now, you have to understand, I'm thinking that the government has fast response teams. They do for everything else, so why not UFOs, right? So I'm thinking that they went in there, and they probably, and I would be willing to bet my bottom dollar this has happened in other zoos, in other places in and outside of our country. And I'm just thinking that they were able to cover those incidents up. Or perhaps they just haven't gotten out to the public yet. I don't know. I've spoken around the country, I've done over 2,000 seminars. So believe me, I've had my share of UFO stories, but most of them didn't involve zoos. This wasn't unique, and I'm sure it's less unique than we know about, because I'm sure in other places they were able, you know, maybe a smaller town, they would have been able to cover it up a lot easier. But you got to remember, it's the government, they got fast response teams, and I'm assuming, I mean, the animals were gone by nightfall the next day. By nightfall the next day. Think about the logistics of that, of getting 300 animals that were strangely killed out of there.
Logistics on both sides, more than 300 animals dead, no blood, but dead. So somehow they got in those cages, and overnight, 300 animals were killed. And that seems even more difficult to do.
Oh, I agree with you. I have no idea. You know, see, I don't know much about the actual aliens, if they are aliens. Whatever they are, they're doing this. That I do know. I'm certain of. And they apparently, their technology is a lot more, it's a lot better than ours, apparently. I don't know. The thing that got me the most was these three people I spoke to, all current workers, too. They weren't previous. They actually were still working there. They all said the same thing. They said an army of people were there within 3 hours the next day. Within 3 hours, moving things out, moving things around. The only reason they stayed, they were stayed to help. They were all asked to help, which they did. So, I mean, this is firsthand. This isn't secondhand sighting. This is firsthand information, which made it extraordinarily valuable to me. By the way, I just want to mention real quickly, I've got a book called The UFO Guy. It's on my website, www.billmillsworld.com. If you want something really good to read, it's only $3.99, and you know what? It's almost 500 pages. So if you want to read a good book with a lot of cool sightings and information in it, stuff you've not heard on the History Channel before, that's a good book to get. But anyway, this whole thing that went down, the thing that got me the most was, he said, they brought numbers of dump trucks over there. And what they did was they put out a story that improvements were being made to the park. Well, the only improvements that were being made to the park was the recreation and redoing of the zoo. That was it. So how they got away with all this. But then, you know, if I called up a newspaper and told them this story, which I have actually done, it's like with Montauk. You mentioned that briefly. And on a future show, we just got to discuss that. But try to tell anybody about it, you're crazy. That never happened, blah, blah, blah. Try to tell them that a whole zoo full of animals in one night, 300 animals were strangely mutilated, drained of blood, and that the whole thing was completely covered up. And in less than a year, the zoo opened up again with brand new buildings for the most part, reseeded grass, ground that was dug up 3 to 6 inches, depending on the area of the park. It's just crazy. But again, it's a very historic area, you know. They wrote about it in different magazines and different books. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote about it. He called it the land of the ashes because in the old days, like I said, coal was the major thing and they dump it in there. But it's going back, you know, at least 100 years, we know that people have had sightings in that area. Now, I think on another time when we talk, I will talk to you a little bit, if you want me to, about human mutilations. That's occurred as well. But nowhere on the scale, nowhere. So I don't want anybody to get freaked out or worried. Nowhere on the scale. Those have been few and far between of these animal mutilations. But the animal mutilations are happening. Out on Long Island, to late 80s, there were a whole series of dog and cat mutilations that occurred out in Suffolk County, along with tremendous numbers of UFOs. In fact, if any of you know Joel Martin, he wrote We Don't Die, an excellent book, and he's a well-known author, radio personality, TV personality, out on Cablevision out there. He had me on his show, and he had some of these people that experienced this on their show. And he would cover unusual topics, as you do.
I want to go back just for a minute to the topsoil being removed. Although the zoo was rebuilt, it's normal, I suppose, to remove, you know, a layer of dirt. Why was this significant for one of the workers to convey this information?
Well, he told me that the grass, all the grass, not some of it, not patches of it like Casino Park, all the grass had been strangely affected. I said, define strangely affected. He said, well, it wasn't green anymore. I said, what color was it? He said, it looked yellow, like it had died. And they didn't want whatever that was in that grass, in that soil, they did not want to leave it there. You know, evidentially speaking, they did not want to leave it there because it would prove that something really crazy happened. But also, honestly, I think it scared them to death. And I don't know, even to this day, oh man, I wish I could have got samples of that because I would definitely have went and, you know, I got that analyzed.
Mutilations, as you already know, Bill, but for listeners, the typical cattle mutilation, they usually have these large oval incisions around the jawbone and expose the jaw completely or remove it. The tongue is usually removed. And sometimes on the cow, the eyeballs are removed. The udders on the female are almost always removed. And the sexual organs are removed. I'm wondering if these types of mutilations occurred with the animals and pets mutilation cases that occurred on Long Island.
They absolutely did. And once again, you were finding animals. They almost looked frightened. Almost like it was flattened by a car or a truck, but not that flat, you know, because all the blood was drained out. The numbers, which went into the hundreds, okay, this wasn't a crazy person, it wasn't a satanic cult, because, again, I defy people to tell me why or how the blood would be removed.
That's a really good point regarding the blood. And on the site of your colleague, Ellie Crystal, crystallinks.com, she quotes Linda Howe. here. According to a 1997 NIDS report, ranchers in Utah were weighing and tagging calves one morning, and they tagged an 87-pound individual. Less than an hour later, reported that they made a shocking discovery in a 45-minute period in daylight, 100 yards from any cover, with the rancher about 200 to 300 yards away. The calf had most of the body weight removed, including entrails, and appeared to have been placed carefully on the ground with no blood present or near the animal. And that kind of gives you an idea of what we're dealing with here with something at the zoo, how quickly something could happen like this without people knowing. So we're definitely seeing the signature of a highly skilled predator.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, this is costly. It's costly in terms of emotional pain that pet owners suffer. It's costly in terms of ranchers that are losing tens of thousands of dollars in animals, you know, and they can barely afford to run their ranches as it is.
Bill Nell, I really appreciate you joining me here to talk about this case. It's one of the most remarkable cases I've ever heard about. I lived in New York for about 18 years, and I did not hear about this. But I do know that the area is a paranormal magnet, and some areas more than others, now that I'm finding out. I really appreciate you researching this, writing about it, and your website again is BillNellsWorld.com. BillNellsWorld.com. I'll put a link on inothernewsradio.com to that as well, and your article about this case that we're talking about. Thank you again so much for being on In Other News.
Thank you for having me.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.